The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Tim DeMoss Show podcast. You can hear the program each weekday afternoon from 4 till 5 on AM 560 WFIL and WFIL.com.
AM 560 WFIL.com and on the app. You're listening to the Tim DeMoss Show. Thank you for tuning in. Kind of a cloudy day with some sun at times, 78 the high. Wow. Cloudy night, low 53. Tomorrow, kind of cloudy again. Maybe a little sun, maybe a shower or two. High 70. Phillies winning in 10 innings last night, 5-3 over St. Louis. Trey Turner and Johan Rojas, each with three hits and a run batted in. Brandon Marsh's third homer on the year. Spencer Turnbull, another solid outing. Six innings pitched, just a couple of hits allowed, no runs. One walk, six strikeouts. They play again this evening at 6:45. Phillies manager Rob Thompson on the rallying in the last part of the game against the Cardinals.
Holmes hit the sack fly by Stott. I mean, that's great at bat off a really, really good reliever. I mean, one of the best in the game. So I was really happy with the fight that we had tonight.
Rob Thompson, Phillies manager, sound courtesy of the NBC Sports YouTube page. Also tonight, Phillies playing 7:45, but also tonight, the Sixers and Flyers in action at 7. The Flyers are at Montreal, and the Sixers are home against Detroit. As far as the Flyers go, down the last few games of the season here, head coach John Tortorella on what makes this last part of the season challenging.
The biggest thing that I think what happens at this time of year, and then especially in playoffs, are just momentum swings. Understanding where the game is going. It's just managing the game. So I said the other night, I think it was in Buffalo, we score a goal, Pales comes down, beats the defense, means a breakaway, hits the post. Instead of us going bang, bang with the two goals and having a momentum swing that way, it's still tied, you know, and it's all how you handle when it's going against you and how you take off with it when it's for you. I think it's a huge part of these types of games at the end of the year and so much more magnified in playoffs.
Flyers head coach John Tortorella, sound courtesy of NHL.com. Last night in hoops, UConn over Purdue, 75-60 to win the men's basketball championship for the second year in a row. First team since Florida in 2006 and 2007 to do that. All six of their wins, just like last year, by 10 or more points. Pretty impressive run, and I'm sure they'll be seeing if they can pull it off again and pull off a three-peat next year. In the meantime, we'll have Eagles football as well to chat about for a moment. It's been well known that Fletcher Cox is retiring, but today made it official, had a press conference, talked a bit about retiring.
This decision was not easy, and I knew at some point in my career it was time for me to retire from NFL. It's obviously the reason that I'm here today. You know, it comes with a lot of emotions. This game is mentally and physically can take a toll on you. And, you know, I've enjoyed it at the highest level. I've been at the highest levels. And at that point, I felt like that I've gave this game all I could give. And, you know, the game is given to me back. You know, I've been part of the highs. I've been part of the lows in this league. And, you know, and I've enjoyed it all. And, you know, as a human, you look at yourself in the mirror and you realize and you ask yourself, you know, is this something that you really want to do? And I told myself, when I make the decision, I want to do it with no regret. And I have no regrets about making this decision to retire from the NFL. So with that, you know, today is a very special day for me. It's a very special day for my family. It's a very special day for this organization. And it's a very, very special day for the city of Philadelphia.
It's Fletcher Cox of the Eagles, one of the most decorated defensive players in their history. Sound courtesy of PhiladelphiaEagles.com. We're looking forward to a really cool conversation today with Dr. Cal Beissner. He's written a book called Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, edited with David R. LeGates, a doctor and a professor formerly of the University of Delaware. Dr. Beisner is founder, president, and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. It's a network of Christian theologians, natural scientists, economists, and other scholars educating for biblical earth stewardship, economic development for the poor, and the proclamation and defense of the gospel, all rolled into one. So I'm really looking forward to having Dr. Beisner on the program today. We'll do a quick break and bring him on board, chat about this book, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. Dr. Cal Beisner in just a moment, listening to The Tim DeMoss Show on WFIL.
It's The Tim DeMoss Show podcast, available at WFIL.com. Thanks for listening.
AM 560 WFIL, it's the Tim DeMoss Show, and we are very glad to bring on board Dr. Cal Beisner. Thank you for taking time, author of Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. We would love to get into that here in a minute. But if you wouldn't mind, just so folks have some context of your background, could you share a bit about that, including the Cornwall Alliance?
Yeah, well, the Cornwall Alliance is a nonprofit Christian think tank that I founded almost 19 years ago now. We're a network of just under 70 different Christian scholars. About a third of them are natural scientists, including, by the way, some of the world's top climate scientists. About a third are economists, most of them specializing in either developmental economics, what are the things that lift whole societies out of poverty and keep them out of it, or environmental economics. And the remaining third tend to be theologians, philosophers, ethicists. And I'm kind of the interdisciplinary guy who pulls all those things together.
Wow.
My own background is in a combination of interdisciplinary work in philosophy, political science, economics, and particularly environmental science, as well as history, and particularly the history of ideas. So I kind of pull all those things together, and we have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Our mission is to educate the public and policymakers on biblical earth stewardship, economic development for the poor, and the gospel of Christ, together with the Christian worldview along with that.
Yeah, it's fascinating to have all of those worlds rolled into one. And it's I'm looking forward to our conversation here about these things, including the book itself, because you've written a lot of books. The newest one, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. Just give a little backstory to how long this has been in the works, and we can get into it bit by bit.
Well, the book itself has been in the works for almost 2.5 years. It was released back on March 19 at last, but we came up with the idea about 2.5 years ago, and then over the intervening time, we got a total of 16 different authors to contribute chapters and their areas of expertise. So this is a pretty substantial work. It's about 450, 460 pages, and covers everything from the basics of climate science, how does our climate work, to what are the contributions to global warming or climate change from the sun, from evaporation and clouds and precipitation, from ocean currents, from human emissions of greenhouse gases, all sorts of things, trying to figure out how much the temperature of the Earth changes in response to these various things, as well as discussing the very important issue of energy availability, because our driving concern, really, is to protect the poor of the world and, in fact, to see them conquer poverty. It's wonderful that we've gone from about 98% of humanity being in extreme poverty up until 2 centuries ago to under 10% today, and I think that's wonderful, but we want to go the rest of the way. And it's great that a couple of billion people around the world have, or about 4 billion people, have consistent access to reliable electricity, but it's awful that about 2 billion people have none, and about another 2.5 or 3 billion people have only very intermittent and unreliable access to electricity, which means, of course, that they go without refrigeration and air conditioning and lights and all sorts of things that we in the West take for granted.
Folks, tuning in, we're chatting with Dr. Carl Beisner, author of the book Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, on a very broad, with a broad brush. When just the phrase global warming, climate change comes up. In your experience every day, because you mentioned that this book is not just for those who may understand all of these concepts or many of them, but just for the everyday person. What is your experience when people, when that word is thrown out in the middle of, out for people to discuss, what comes to the surface initially?
Yeah, almost always when people think of global warming or climate change, they have a sort of a catastrophist narrative in mind. This is going to be an existential threat to humanity. It may threaten all life on Earth. I just recently heard a short clip of a British environmentalist and documentary producer, actually knighted by the late Queen Elizabeth, saying that the planet will be boiling. I mean, that's
wow.
Really absurd. The boiling point of water is 212 degrees Fahrenheit, and right now average temperature in the world is 59 degrees, and nowhere does it get above about 120 to 130 degrees in nature. I mean, these kinds of claims are absurd, but they're the kinds of things that are bantied about in the mainstream news and by politicians and so on. That's just simply false. The best empirical evidence, the best scientific evidence, is that human-induced climate change is real, but it's not catastrophic. We can adapt to it much more cheaply than we can try to control global temperature. And the effort to control global temperature is likely to deprive people of the abundant, affordable, reliable energy in massive quantities that is absolutely indispensable to lifting and keeping whole societies out of poverty. And since poverty is a far greater risk than anything related to climate or weather, trapping people in poverty or pushing them back into it means shortening their lives, and certainly abandoning all fossil fuels quickly would result probably in the starvation within a matter of months to a year or so of roughly half the world's population.
Wow. And if you're just tuning in, again, we're chatting with Dr. Kyle Beissner, author of Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, with a lot of folks contributing, edited by yourself, and Dr. David LaGates, who has a local tie. He was a professor, I believe, at the University of Delaware, so not far from here.
That's correct.
Yeah. And in the prologue, I believe he wrote the prologue, he wrote, summed up kind of what you're saying a bit about climate science is truly in a perilous situation. We hope this book will contribute to its recovery. He begins by talking about how when you talk about global warming and climate change, that there is an alarmist mindset and explains mm-hmm. why, right? And so, and then you go on from there as far as helping straighten not just that narrative out, but unpacking it and including some of the things you've touched on there. In the preface, you mentioned anthropogenic global warming is real, but unlikely to become catastrophic, which you just shared there. And then the cost-benefit ratio of adapting is that what we face is better than that of mitigation. Mitigation is when you try to just control it. Is that right?
Right. Mitigation is trying to slow, stop, or even reverse the global warming that's being driven partly by human emissions of greenhouse gases, but partly by various natural causes as well. So that's mitigation. Adaptation means we do what we need to do to adapt to whatever the temperature is. I mean, we have heaters in the winter. We use air conditioners in the summer, right?
Right.
And we can adapt to weather from the Arctic Circle to the Sahara Desert to the Brazilian rainforest if we have adequate income. But if we're struggling to get along on, say, the equivalent of a dollar or two a day, we can't thrive in the best tropical paradise. So this is why overcoming poverty and keeping prosperity is far more important than trying to control the global climate.
Yeah, and it's funny because I think people could be well-intentioned in their minds, well, we should do what we can to save the planet or something,
yes.
But don't think about, well, the way you're going about it, though, actually was going to have the reverse effect. And do you find that people haven't even really thought about that very much?
Oh, yeah, I find that a great deal. The problem is that it's easy for us to focus just on one thing and not to see long-term consequences and wide consequences for a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. So if we say, well, okay, we don't like the air pollution that comes from burning coal to generate electricity. Well, okay, we just eliminate the coal, and then we eliminate that air conditioning, that air pollution. Well, the funny thing, I just slipped there in what I said. Yeah, we'll also eliminate a lot of air conditioning.
Right.
But we forget about all the benefits that come from the electricity that you get from burning that coal. And among those benefits is the wealth necessary to afford a technology that removes all that air pollution when you burn the coal. So, yeah. You know, frankly, a clean, healthful, beautiful environment is a costly good. And wealthier people can afford more costly goods than poorer people can. And abundant, affordable, reliable energy is indispensable to making people wealthy. And that means that the abundant, affordable, reliable energy that you get from coal or natural gas for electricity, or from oil turned into diesel or gasoline for transport fuel, all of that has benefits that far outweigh the risks brought in by the pollution that comes from them.
Dr. Kyle Beissner, our guest today on the Tim DeMoss Show on WFIL in Philadelphia, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism is the book we're talking about. And I think it's maybe fairly obvious, but if you could just define realism, or the case for realism is really what this book is about. But how would you define that if you were defining your terms? Climate and energy are pretty straightforward, too.
Yeah, I define it in contrast to two opposite ends of a spectrum. On the one end, there's climate alarmism or climate catastrophism, the notion that climate change driven by human activity is going to be a catastrophic or even existential threat to humanity and even the rest of life on Earth. On the opposite end is climate or climate change denialism, and that says, oh, human activity has zero effect on global climate or even perhaps on local climate. Both of those are just quite thoroughly contrary to the best empirical evidence. Climate realism says, yes, human activity contributes to shaping the climate on local, regional, and global levels, but the results are not catastrophic. They're likely to be more beneficial than harmful. Trying to slow, stop, or reverse our contribution to climate change by abandoning the most important sources of energy that we have and substituting diffuse, expensive, unreliable sources like wind and solar is likely to have far more harmful than beneficial effects. And what we really need to do is to pursue policies based on a very careful, proper cost-benefit analysis. We also need to take into account, by the way, not just the weather and climate effects of what we do, but other effects. For example, all of the benefits we get from all that energy, but also the benefits that we get from carbon dioxide itself, which people are blaming for global warming, though its contribution to that is actually quite small compared with natural forces. Carbon dioxide is actually indispensable to life. It's the elixir of life is what I've heard some scientists call it. Plants need it to do photosynthesis, and the more they get, the better they grow, and therefore the more food is available for everything that eats plants or eats something that does eat plants. And the poor benefit from that more than anybody else. The CO2 we've added to the atmosphere over the last 60 years or so, or 200 years or so, has resulted in a huge greening of the planet. And that's a good thing.
Dr. Kyle Beissner is our guest on the Tim DeMoss Show today on WFIL in Philadelphia, along with David R. LeGates, from the formerly of the University of Delaware, co-written a book, and some other authors helped out. Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. We'll keep our conversation going in a moment. You're listening to the Tim DeMoss Show, AM 560, WFIL.com, and on the WFIL app.
Have a guest you'd like to hear on the Tim DeMoss Show on AM 560 WFIL? Email timmyd@wfil.com.
AM 560 WFIL.com and on the app. You're listening to the Tim DeMoss Show. Thank you for tuning in. My guest, Dr. Calvin Beissner, who along with Dr. David LeGates, former professor at the University of Delaware, put together this new book, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. A number of other authors contribute to this book as well. It's interesting, as you're talking there, I was thinking about Dr. LaGates, who you co-edited the book with, and I was watching a video where there was a show, Democracy Now!, had like 2 million followers on their YouTube channel, and he was mentioned as introduced as a climate change denier. And they showed a clip of him saying what you just said, that carbon dioxide isn't a pollutant, but instead is a benefit. And then they brought a guest on who worked at NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, as Dr. LaGates was being appointed to. And the person opposed Dr. LaGates' views, saying he was in the 3% of the science community that felt that way. And a couple things came across my mind. Number one is, It's something to make a statement without then talking to the person you're making the statement about. Instead, you're just reinforcing your own opinion by bringing someone else on board who agrees with you. And the reason I mention that is because if you could shed a little light, and this is in the book, but why things feel so one-sided, because I don't have personally a deep knowledge of these things. But if you asked me, if we're playing a game, word association, global warming, climate change, I'd think about, you know, probably the negative side of things or the worries that come with those words.
Yeah.
Right. So why do you think that is?
Well, a lot of it is because the environmental movement around the world and liberal politics, particularly socialist or Marxist politics, have formed really a very powerful influence bloc. And they have most of the control of the mainstream media around the world. There's another little bit of journalistic or media wisdom that goes into this, and that's the old saying that bad news is good news is no news. Because for some strange reason, human psychology, people are far more interested in bad news than good news, which means that they read stories, they watch news stories about bad news, and they skip over the ones about good news. Well, if you're trying to pay the bills for your newspaper or your TV station or your broadcast network or whatever, you depend on advertising dollars. Advertising dollars comes when you can promise eyeballs, and eyeballs come when you tell people bad news. So that's a part of it all. The stories are a good deal more complex than that.
Yeah.
But you mentioned that these folks said that David was among the 3% of scientists. No, that's not at all the case. First off, by the way, consensus is not science.
Right,
doesn't
right.
matter how many people agree. That's an old fallacy. Aristotle identified that as the fallacy of popular vote. So consensus isn't science. But second, the claims of 97% consensus among scientists that global warming is real and catastrophic and we need to spend trillions of dollars trying to revamp our energy infrastructure around the world to fight it, there's no consensus on that at all. When the American Meteorological Association polled its members, it got about 50% consensus that climate change was mostly human-induced, but nothing about it's catastrophic, nothing about we have to spend trillions of dollars trying to fight it. And so, as a matter of fact, I think the larger majority of scientists would be more toward what we describe as the realistic position.
Hmm.
And by the way, that's even the position of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which most people point to as the world authority on this, right?
Yeah.
Hey, in 2018, the UN IPCC published a report called Special Report on Global Warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius. In that, they said that even if we did nothing to slow or stop global warming from now to the end of this century, that warming would only reduce global domestic product by about 2.6% at the end of the century. But that would be 2.6% not of today's gross world product, but of gross world product that can be expected to have risen by about 8 or 9 times between now and then. In short, the implication is, if we did nothing to fight global warming, the average person in the world would be about almost 9 times as wealthy as today. And if we tried to, because of that warming, maybe he would be only about 8.5 times as wealthy instead. That's not disaster.
No, not whatsoever. Folks, tuning in with Dr. Carl Beisner, author of the book Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, along with David R. LeGates and a number of folks who contributed to the different chapters here. There's something you said a minute ago also that I think Dr. LeGates put at the beginning of chapter two, the history and politics of climate change. People with a sense of fulfillment think it is a good world and would like to conserve it as it is, while the frustrated favor radical change. And that seems to come through when it comes to global warming. And again, I would associate that the negativity or the alarmist side is, well, we got to find something else. In fact, there's a part of the book where I believe he talks about folks who are interested with global cooling first, and when that got resolved, they found something else to be unhappy about or something like that.
Exactly. Exactly. As I mentioned earlier, there's something about human psychology that indicates we all get fascinated by bad news, by disasters. And so you can go back through history and see over and over and over again where people have expected that some great disaster was around the corner, and it never came. You know, that's not to say that there never are disasters, but the ones that we predict as a consequence of human activity almost never do materialize. That was the case with overpopulation. Paul Ehrlich, in his book, The Population Bomb in 1968, said that no matter what we did, hundreds of millions of people would die of starvation in the 1970s because of famines. He was absolutely wrong. None of that happened. And in fact, famines stopped, aside from the few cases where they were caused by political warfare. He predicted that we would run out of a whole bunch of different metals, minerals. We didn't. The supplies were better at the end of the 70s than at the beginning of the 70s. People were fearful of global cooling and even a coming ice age in the 1960s and 70s. Instead, we flipped to being fearful of global warming. But the reality is, none of these things have come about. And we live in a planet that is wonderfully designed by our omniscient, omnipotent, and faithful God to be a robust, resilient, and largely self-correcting place. We do not do enormous harm. The idea that our increasing carbon dioxide from 0.028 of 1% of the atmosphere, which it was before the Industrial Revolution, to 0.042 of 1% of the atmosphere, which is what it is right now, would cause catastrophic changes to climate. That's just simply foolish on any worldview, but particularly on a worldview that says that an infinitely wise God designed, an infinitely powerful God created, and an infinitely faithful God preserves and sustains his world, including his climate system.
Dr. Carl Beisner, our guest today on the Tim DeMoss Show on WFIL in Philadelphia. We're talking about the book Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. And one of the reasons I was really glad and am glad to have a chance to talk with you is, you know, the reality is we live in a world that's very fast paced, that people want, you know, they give you 15 seconds, and if you don't interest them, they're on to the next thing. So the importance of a book like this to me, I think, is even, you know, it's a longer read, but it's going to offer the opportunity for a person, if they want to be honest with themselves, to educate themselves, because the speed at which the culture moves, if all you're doing is Google searching a topic and you go with the first thing at the top of the search engine, and well, that must be reality, well, then that's what you're doing. But if you want to actually dig in, because this is very, you have a team of scientific experts in various fields, the documentation even for some chapters is almost longer than the chapter, because it's just, you're really, right, you're putting down, here's the stuff. So I say that as a backstory. I want to take a minute then, if you don't mind, I want to just read something you wrote, and then you could maybe just give folks tuning in a chance to, again, get an appreciation for what this work is about. You wrote, I believe it's you had written, the following 15 chapters will provide solid scientific, engineering, and economic reasons to think that human-induced climate change, while real is extremely unlikely to become catastrophic, and that adaptation, rather than mitigation, trying to control global temperature, will have better results for humanity and the rest of life on Earth. Chapter 2 traces the history and politics of the climate change movement. Chapters 3 through 10, 9 climate scientists explain how Earth's climate works, how climate scientists seek to model Earth's climate to anticipate future climate change, and the roles of the sun, oceans, evaporation, precipitation, and clouds, and greenhouse gases in shaping Earth's climate. Chapter 9 examines the holy grail of climate change, how much global average temperature is likely to rise in response to our additions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, and Chapter 10 describes the likely effects of warming, and then Chapters 11 to 16, five scholars in engineering and economics of energy, two with expertise in climate science, explain why and how human thriving depends on abundant, affordable, reliable energy, and what are the best sources of that energy. So I want to just take a minute to read that, because to give folks an overview of the breadth of this, and that you have about 10 or 12 authors writing a chapter or two, including yourself and including Dr. LeGates, as part of that. But at the end, there's an appendix, which I just want to make sure people know about, because the education comes from reading this book, but there's also the nature of, you know, there's history and there's the future too, how to keep kind of get your mind around these things.
Yeah, right. And, you know, what that appendix does, by the way, is it tells of climate papers that those who are really interested in getting deep into the issue can read. These have been published in peer-reviewed journals running back over a century, actually, and they are like the best papers available. But let me pick up on something else that you said, and that is that these things can be very complicated and can seem like it can take a long time to grasp. That's why every chapter in this book starts off with a summary, with a chapter summary that is designed for ordinary people, not experts, right? To be able to read that quickly, typically in 5 or 6 minutes,
right,
and get the gist of each chapter, which I think makes the book extra valuable.
Very much
and,
so.
We hope that this will also make it more useful for policymakers, very, very busy people holding public office in Congress or in the administration or in city councils and county boards of supervisors and the like. These people are busy. They need something that they can grasp quickly. That summary at the start of each chapter gives them exactly that. And then if they want to dive deeper, they can read the full chapter.
Dr. Beisner, one question for you, because in the preface, you referenced the fact that the book is for experts and, you know, the president and Congress and mayors and folks who are in charge of things, but also very much underscoring, as you just did, that the book is intended to help the everyday person, a lay person, come to well-informed, wise decisions. And I was wondering if you could give an example or two of what a layman or a lay person like a practical application of some of the things they might read in Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. I have one thought in my head, but I'll see what you might have as an example.
Okay. You know, you could pretty much do two or three out of every single chapter in the book, but let me just focus on what I think is one of the most important messages of this book.
Okay.
And that is that the demand that we should rapidly replace coal, oil, and natural gas, hydrocarbon fuels, which currently provide about 85% of all the energy that we use around the world, that we should rapidly replace those with wind and solar and other so-called renewable energy sources. That demand is extremely impractical, and attempting to live by it would, I believe, condemn billions of people around the world in very short order, not just to a little inconvenience, but to starvation. Roughly half the people in the world right now depend entirely for their food on agriculture that is driven overwhelmingly by the use of fertilizers that are derived from natural gas. If we stop producing natural gas as an energy source, we'll also stop producing it as a fertilizer source, because it's not cost effective without the energy aspect. That would mean we would cut off the production of the food that half the human race depends on.
Chat with Dr. Cal Beisner. Climate and Energy is the book, The Case for Realism, edited along with Dr. David R. Gates. We're going to keep our conversation going in just a moment. You're listening to The Tim DeMoss Show, AM 560, WFIL.com, and on the WFIL app.
Thanks for tuning in to the Tim DeMoss Show podcast with AM 560 WFIL and WFIL.com.
AM 560 WFIL.com and on the app, you're listening to the Tim DeMoss Show. Thank you for tuning in. Our guest today, Dr. Cal Beisner. He's written a book called Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, edited along with Dr. David LeGates, former professor at the University of Delaware, and a number of other contributors to this book. Dr. Beisner also is founder, president, and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. It's a network of Christian theologians, natural scientists, economists, and other scholars educating for a biblical earth stewardship, economic development for the poor, and the proclamation and defense of the good news of salvation by God's grace received through faith in Jesus Christ's death and resurrection. Dr. Beisner also has written over 15 books, edited over 30, and contributed over 35, published thousands of articles, popular and scholarly. We are very privileged to have him on the program today talking about this book, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. Before the break, we were talking about hydrocarbon fuels, coal, oil, natural gas, about 85% of the world's energy source, and then move to rapidly replace those with wind, solar, and renewable energy sources, and how that's is problematic. Specifically, you were talking about how, I guess, roughly half the people in the world right now depend entirely for their food on agriculture, driven largely by the use of fertilizers derived from natural gas. And if we stop producing natural gas as an energy source, that's also going to mean the fertilizer source goes away because it's not cost effective to do that part of it without using the energy part. So that would mean we'd be cutting off the production of the food that nearly half the human race depends on.
So it sounds like that should be obvious, but maybe it really isn't to people who should know that it's obvious. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. But we're trying to put the basic facts out here for people to grasp. And, you know, something that we all need to remember is, you know, very, very few people in decision-making positions, whether in the administration or in the Congress or in city councils and the like, very few people in those decision-making positions are themselves experts in climate science or energy engineering or economics or anything like that. The most common profession for members of Congress is law. Well, most lawyers are not scientists or energy engineers. And so that's why this kind of a book is so crucial, is to help them, who are really just like all of us in the public, non-experts, to grasp things well enough to make wise decisions about policy.
And that makes total sense. I've always wondered how anybody, especially the president, but anybody in a position of authority with a lot of decisions to make, they've got to have great people around them who know what they're saying and can lean on. But at the same time, there are a lot of people walking the planet, and a person can waltz into a circle of influence and perhaps not be given the best advice, maybe even unintentionally. They just don't know any better. And
absolutely.
Yeah. You know,
we don't have to attack people's motivations. We don't have to say, oh, this person is wicked or something like that. We just recognize people can act without sufficient information.
Yeah. So here's one practical offshoot, because I actually had jotted down solar powered roofs as a thought. We've had advertisements come in the mail, little pamphlets and things, if you're interested. We just actually got our roof done not long ago, so it's not even something. But I thought, oh, that might be interesting, or would that help reduce our energy costs? The book Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, is written very even-handedly, like you said. There are some results of human-generated issues. That's not like it's, oh, none of that exists, but it's not the alarmist end of the spectrum either. And there are a lot of other examples where there are acknowledgments of, yeah, that could be a problem, or that is a problem, but it's not anywhere near the problems created by solutions that are being proposed. So I was thinking, as an example, if a layperson was interested in getting a solar powered roof, would it be something in your mind like, well, that's okay if you want to, or is it more try not to be part of that narrative because you may inadvertently be, you know, shifting the cultural mindset that we all have to have solar powered roofs? What are your thoughts on something like that, perhaps?
Well, the answer can vary based on a number of different factors. For one thing, if you live in the Pacific Northwest, which has cloudy skies most of the time all through the year, solar power is not going to be very promising. If you live in Arizona, hey, the odds there are much better. Okay, so that's part of what goes into it. But then we also have to think in terms of cost-benefit analysis. I remember a few years ago, there was an article in one magazine celebrating the wonders of rooftop solar and using an example of a family in Hawaii that chose to do that and how much money they saved on their monthly utility bill by doing this. Well, what they forgot was that they needed to factor into that the cost of the solar panels and their installation on the roof, the cost of cleaning them regularly, and their expected life expectancy, and when they would be able to break even. And they also needed, and this is what almost everybody forgets, they needed to figure, to think, all right, if I hadn't spent the $25,000 on solar panels, what if I had invested that at a market index rate over the life expectancy of the solar panels? Would I have come out better off having bought the panels or having invested the money? And when you ran those figures, it turned out, what you saved in your electric bills monthly was a small fraction of what you'd have earned by investing that same money over the lifespan of the panels.
Interesting.
So there are all kinds of different things. I can't give a single answer. I can't say, it never makes sense. No, that would not be correct. But I can't say it always makes sense. That would also not be correct.
Yeah.
People just need to go into it with their eyes open, with an understanding of the various different factors that need to be considered, and then make the best decision that they can. Realizing, too, by the way, that whereas, you know, solar companies will say this has an expected life expectancy of such and such, maybe 25 years, all kinds of conditions can reduce that very significantly. And it tends to be the case that most solar panels outrun their usefulness in about 15 to 18 years instead of 25. And then, by the way, they have to be disposed of, and there are all kinds of toxic chemicals in them that make that disposal dangerous.
Interesting. If you're just tuning in, we're chatting with Dr. Cal Beisner. Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism is the book we're talking about. And I think what I was kind of referring to is maybe the notion that the book, the tone of Climate and Energy, and as we're talking here, I think people can pick up on it, is it's not an all or nothing. And it's not a, as you said, it has to make sense in your particular situation. It was more the idea of the culture in which, well, everyone needs to do this to be a responsible citizen, or something along the lines of, and you mentioned like replacing coal, oil, natural gas with wind and solar, the rapid replacement. I think what I'm asking is if you feel like, well, it's okay if you want to do wind or solar or some other renewable energy, but to also make this A, happen very quickly, and B, kind of create an environment where everyone feels guilty or bad if they don't do it, or you're forcing everyone to do this, that doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, I would say that there are places around the world where wind and solar can be pretty effective. Those are mostly desert places. They tend not to be in the temperate zones, and they tend not to be in areas that are very cloudy or anything like that.
Yeah.
But even there are more things to look at about wind and solar, and particularly about batteries that need to be used to have backup power for when it's not windy or it's not sunny. You know, the lithium that is used in the batteries and the neodymium and various other so-called rare earth metals that are used in wind turbines and solar panels, the cobalt that's used in batteries, these things are very, very difficult to mine and refine. And when you count up all of the earth that must be moved in order to get the adequate supplies of lithium, cobalt, and the various rare earth metals for wind turbines, solar panels, and batteries, it turns out you need to do a whole lot more earth moving and a whole lot more mineral refining to get the same amount of energy that way that you get from mining coal or drilling for oil or natural gas. And the result is that actually what we refer to as the green, clean energies are probably worse for the natural environment than coal, oil, and natural gas. And, you know, I must mention here, too, nuclear energy is absolutely fabulous. If we want to move anywhere from coal and natural gas for the generating of electricity, it's not to wind and solar, it's to nuclear. That's the safest form we have, and it could be, if it were not hampered by needlessly excessive regulations, the cheapest form of energy for generating electricity in the world. And I think we will be going more and more to that.
Dr. Cal Beisner, thank you for taking time today. The book Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, along with David R. LeGates, Dr. LeGates, a former professor at the University of Delaware, a team of other folks who contributed to this. Is there a best place for folks to keep up with you about this book and in general? I'm not sure if there's a way you blog or there are other ways people can pick your brain or hear more about these things.
Sure. Well, of course, they can get it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble and many other booksellers. They can do it that way. But I mentioned earlier, the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation is what really stood behind producing this book. And if you don't mind my saying this, I will point out that during the month of April, as our way of saying thank you, when people donate any amount, and it will be 100% tax deductible, to the Cornwall Alliance, and ask for the book, we'll be glad to send them a free copy.
Oh, wow.
Any amount of donation. They can do that by going to cornwallalliance.org. That's cornwallalliance.org/donate. And then when they fill out the donation form, just ask for Climate and Energy. We'll be glad to send them a copy of the book. And the donation will be 100% tax deductible.
That's great. And we will put that in the podcast description so they can have that reference handy in case they didn't get a chance to jot it down just now. Wonderful.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for taking time. Real pleasure to make your acquaintance, to read through the book and to learn from you and the team that you've assembled. And hopefully we can have you on again and or some of the folks on the team, too.
We'd love to do that. Thank you.
God bless you. Have a great rest of your day.
You too.
All right. Dr. Cal Beisner, author of Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, along with Dr. David R. LeGates. He's also founder, president, and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, which is a network of Christian theologians, natural scientists, economists, and other scholars educating for biblical earth stewardship, economic development for the poor, and the proclamation and defense of the good news of salvation by God's grace received through faith in Jesus Christ's death and resurrection. Very glad to have him on the program today. We have just enough time, by the way, because it's a week from Thursday. To remind you, there is a Pastor's Appreciation Breakfast coming up with Alan Jackson from Alan Jackson Ministries. It's happening at Radnor Valley Country Club Thursday, April 18th. Pastor Jackson joined us on the program not too long ago and, among other things, shared a bit about his testimony.
It really started when I was a boy. We went to church every week, but we weren't Christians. And you can do that in any church. And my mom was diagnosed with cancer when I was 7, and the doctors told her she had 6 months to live. They were the youth leaders in the church, but she didn't know the Lord. So they were on a plane on the way to Mayo Clinic, and she said a little prayer, "If there's a God, let me know the truth before I die so I can tell my boys." And they got to Mayo Clinic, did a four-day workup, and the doctor came to see her, and he said, "Ms. Jackson, you had cancer. We've had pictures of it, but we can't find it. We've looked for 4 days. Go home and raise your baby." And so that opened the door. A Sunday school teacher, who's an airline pilot, told my parents you could be born again. And so in his living room, they knelt at a coffee table. And I walked in the kitchen and said, "What's happened? This is a different place to live." And they told me, and I knelt in the kitchen floor and accepted the Lord. So I'm happy for churches. I work in one, but I also understand God works outside the church in some pretty profound ways, too.
Pastor Alan Jackson from Alan Jackson Ministries, which you can catch weekday mornings at 6 on WFIL. Again, Pastor Jackson going to be our keynote speaker at WFIL's Pastors Appreciation Breakfast, Thursday, April 18th, a week from this Thursday.
Delicious food, fellowship, a time of worship, every pastor in attendance receiving a resource bag. Plus, we're going to have prizes to give away. Should be a great time. Pastors, you can get your tickets a couple ways. One by calling 610-729-1270, 610-729-1270, or at WFIL.com. Just click through the Pastor's Appreciation Breakfast banner. Thanks for listening in to Tim DeMoss Show today. Alistair Begg and Truth for Life on the way on AM 560 WFIL.
Thanks for listening to the Tim DeMoss Show podcast. Feel free to tune in to the full show each weekday afternoon from 4 till 5 on AM 560 WFIL and at WFIL.com.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.